Chapter 4. Downtown. A few days after Bloomsday, I walked down Broad Street and spotted Henry Boleyn measuring the width of a man's shoulders with his measuring tape. I knocked on the plate glass window of Boleyn's clothing store. He made a notation with a piece of chalk, waved at me, then called out, "Hey, jailbird!" That wicked yet good-natured salutation always made me laugh. I hadn't forgotten that Henry Boleyn had been one of the first Charleston adults to embrace my re-entry into life after my turbulent week as the most famous unnamed drug dealer in the county. Though the News and Courier could not use my name because I was underage, Leo King came up in even the most casual conversations on every street and restaurant that month. By calling me Jailbird, Mr. Boleyn had offered the first exit out of my predicament by allowing me to laugh at myself. Normally, I would have stopped and talked to him, but he was busy with a customer, and I was cutting it close for an appointment with my shrink, Jacqueline Criddle. She was as serious about time as a watch repairman, so I jogged to her office above an antique store. I passed through an alley, then took a flight of flimsily built stairs to the second story and entered an air-conditioned room that was an oasis of good taste and serenity there in the heart of downtown, sitar music playing on a stereo. When I had first come to this room, I was still fresh from my traumatic trial in juvenile court. It took me more than a year before I could begin to appreciate the rainforesty tranquility of the room, which smelled of hyacinths and ferns. After a rocky start, I had come to revere the skills of Dr. Criddle as she proceeded with infinite care to put my life in order again. Soundlessly, a green light came on above her office door. I entered and went straight for the leather chair where I always sat facing her. "Good afternoon, Dr. Criddle," I said. "Good afternoon, Leo," she replied. Though I was a teenage boy locked in that maddening, wet-behind-the-ears stage of complete social unease, I thought that all women over 30 years old were menopausal and approaching their deathbeds. But it was not lost on me that Dr. Jacqueline Criddle was a most attractive woman, with an admirable figure and pretty legs. "So how goes it, Mr. Leo King?" She looked over some notes from my file. I thought about it before I answered. "It's going great, Dr. Criddle." She glanced up with a quizzical eye. "You've never said that to me in all our time together. What's happened, Leo?" "I think I'm in the middle of living a good week. Maybe a real good one." "Whoa, back up. Hold your horses. You sound like you're on drugs for sure." "I'm feeling so good." I paused. "I'm even starting to like my mother a little bit." My shrink laughed. "Now surely that's a hallucination." "I've found myself feeling pity for her. I've put my parents through a lot. Did you know that my mother was once a Catholic nun?" "Yes," she said. "I was aware of that." "Why didn't you tell me?"
"It never came up, Leo," she said. "You never mentioned it."
"I just found out."
"Why wouldn't she tell me something like that?"
"She must have thought it'd only make things worse for you."
"I guess. But things couldn't have been much worse, could they?"
"They were pretty bad," said Dr. Criddle.
"But you've come a long way. You're the pride of juvenile court."
I laughed. "Music for my mother's heart."
"She's actually proud of what you've accomplished," Dr. Criddle told me. "You've done everything the court has asked of you, and much, much more."
"Y'all kept me busy."
"Judge Alexander called today. He wants all of us to clean up our business with you this summer."
"I still have 100 hours of community service to finish."
"He's cut it down to 50.
"What about Mr. Cannon?"
"He needs me." "I've called him, Leo. It's true that he fully expected you to be his personal manservant for the rest of his life, but he'll have to make do."
"He's told me as much."
"What a dreadful man," she said. When they assigned you to him, I argued that it was cruel and unusual punishment. He's all alone in the world, I explained. I think I'm all he's got. He's afraid to let people see his kind side, always looking for trouble that never comes. I'm grateful to him, to all of you. You especially, Doctor. You've done the work, Leo, she said. I could feel her withdrawing into her shell like a box turtle you stumble on in the woods. I've facilitated your therapy. Remember, I'm just court-appointed. Remember how I was when I first came to this office with my parents? You were a big mess. How big? She picked up my file from the table that separated us. It was thick enough to strike an ominous chord in me each time she displayed it. In my mind, my file represented some cold-blooded book of hours compiled with malice by that most cunning enemy of my childhood, myself. Here is how I described you at that time. Leo King seems terrified, depressed, anxious, ashamed, totally confused, and possibly suicidal. Don't you miss that guy? I asked. No, I don't. But it took a lot of work to get where we are today. I've never had an adolescent boy work as hard to make himself well. Your mother looked like she wanted to kill you that day. Your dad looked like he wanted to run far away with you and leave no forwarding address. There was such agony in this room. That was almost 3 years ago. You spotted my mother that first day, I remembered. She is a formidable woman, she said. A good woman, but she overpowered you and your dad that day. Nothing's changed there, I told her. We're still not in her league. But you've learned strategies to work around her. And with her. Do you remember what your dad did that day? He cried for an hour. Couldn't stop. Said I blamed him for Steve's death. You did blame him. At least a little bit. It was the only clue I had, Dr. Criddle. The week before he died, Steve was sleeping when I heard him screaming, "No, Father, no, please." I woke him up, and Steve told me he was having a nightmare. He laughed about it. Then he was dead. "I've never seen a father love a boy like yours loves you, Leo," she said. "You've never liked my mother, though." "Don't go putting words in my mouth," she said. "Fair enough, Doctor. But you've taught me to tell you the truth. Otherwise, therapy isn't worth a hill of beans. Your exact words. Here is what I think is true. You don't like my mother." "What I think about her is irrelevant," she said. "It's what you think about her that counts." "I've come to terms with her." "That's a great accomplishment. Sometimes that's the best we can do. You've become patient and forgiving with your mom. I'm not sure I could do the same in your shoes." "She's not your mother." "Thank God," Dr. Criddle said, and we both laughed. Heading north on King Street, I jaywalked to the other side, moving toward Harrington Cannon's antique dealership across from the Satilli Theater. Because I had the Southern boy's disease of needing to be liked by everyone I met, Mr. Cannon had presented me with the dilemma of being impossible to please about anything. I never had to worry about whether Mr. Cannon would be in a good mood. He lived out his whole life as an anthem to the pleasures of a bad mood. Our first weeks together had been nightmarish, and it took me a while to grow accustomed to his starchiness. It was not that he lived as though he were wearing a crown of thorns that bothered me, but that he cherished those thorns and would have it no other way. When I approached the doorway of his shop, it was so dark my eyes had to adjust before he materialized, his head reminiscent of a great horned owl, at his English writing desk against the back wall. "You're sweating like an upcountry hog," he said. "Go wash up before your bodily fluids stain my precious merchandise." "Hey, Mr. Cannon." "Why, I'm doing just peachy, sir, and so's my family. Thanks for your kind inquiries." "You are white trash, pure and simple, Leo. A sad fact that you bitterly resent. I would never think of inquiring about your family, because, sir, like you, they mean nothing to me." "Does an upcountry hog sweat more than the ones around Charleston?" I asked. Low country hogs are too well bred to sweat. I've seen you sweat, much worse than an up country hog. You are a scoundrel even to suggest such a thing. He eyed me through glasses as thick as my own. Charlestonians never sweat. We sometimes do up like hydrangea bushes or well-tended lawns. Well, you sure do up a lot, Mr. Cannon. But I always thought it was because you were tighter than a tick and refused to turn on the air conditioner in this store. Ah, you are referring to my prudence, my admirable frugality. No, sir. I was referring to your cheapness. You told me once you could squeeze a penny hard enough to make Lincoln get a nosebleed. Lincoln, the great Antichrist, the defiler of the South. I'd like to give him more than a nosebleed. I still think John Wilkes Booth is one of the most underrated of American heroes. How are your feet feeling? When did you earn a medical degree, sir? He asked. The last time I looked, my feet belonged to me and me alone. I don't recall handing them over to you with a bill of sale. Mr. Cannon, I said, exhausted by the subject already, you know your doctor asked me to make sure you soaked your feet in hot water and Epsom salts. He's worried about you not taking care of yourself. It was a disgraceful breach of confidentiality, Mr. Cannon said. I'm still thinking about filing a report to the medical authorities and having him defrocked. He had no right to reveal such intimate details of my life to a common criminal. I started weaving my way through a narrow path of bureaus and cabinets until I reached the frayed drapery that led to a broken-down kitchen. I turned on the hot water, waited until it burned my hand, then filled an enamel wash basin half full. I poured in a cup of Epsom salts, then made my way back to Mr. Cannon's desk at a much slower pace. I had once spilled hot water on one of his overpriced dining tables, and he acted as though I had cut the thumb off the Christ child. His moods were predictable and ran from mercurial to stormy. Today seemed to be an easy day, and I predicted nothing but small craft warnings for the rest of the afternoon. I will not put my feet in that lava, he said, his mouth set in a thin line. It'll cool down in a sec, I said, checking my watch. A sec? Is that a unit of time? I've been living in the South for over 60 years, and I've never heard of something called a sec. Possibly you've taken up a new foreign language at that second-rate public school you attend. I tested the water temperature with my index finger, and heard Mr. Cannon shout at me, "Please do not add your stockpile of schoolyard germs to my footbath. I may be fastidious and old maidish, but good hygiene I take with the utmost seriousness." "Stick your smelly tootsies in here, Mr. Cannon." I watched him slip out of a pair of elegant leather-tooled moccasins. He moaned with pleasure as his feet entered the hot water. Again I checked my watch. 10 minutes, and then I'll be back to dry your feet with my hair. A Mary Magdalene kind of moment. Could you sweep out the shop for me today, Leo? And if there's time, I'd like you to polish the 2 English sideboards in the front. Do them right, and with great reverence. They speak volumes about the superiority of Mother England. Be glad to, sir, I said. I'll be back to change your water in a bit. A bit? Isn't that something that's part of a horse's bridle? Or a small particle of almost anything? Or what a snake does to me in the past tense? If you insist on speaking English to me, Leo, I demand a modicum of precision from my employees. I grabbed the broom and dustpan before I said, I am not your employee. The courts of Charleston have punished me by making me your slave. I'm paying my debt to society by cleaning your foul antique store and washing your smelly feet. You seem to like slavery. I adore it. I always knew I would. My family owned hundreds of slaves for centuries. Alas, there was the Emancipation Proclamation. Alas, came Appomattox. Alas, Reconstruction. I was born into the age of alas. Then, when you thought life could get no worse, alas, came Leo King. He laughed a rare laugh. I far preferred it when you trembled in your boots whenever you walked into this store. I love the smell of fear, glandular and base, given off by the servant classes. But then you figured me out, Leo. I've always rued that day. You mean the day I found out you were a pussycat? Yes, that day, that damnable day. I let my guard down in a moment of uncharacteristic weakness, Mr. Cannon said. I loathe all base emotions, all sentimental claptrap. You caught me off guard, undefended. You did not know it, but I was under heavy medication that day. I was not myself, and you took advantage of my enfeeblement. I brought your Father's Day card, I said. You cried like a baby. I most certainly did not. You most certainly did. And Father's Day is coming up again, and I'm getting you another one. I forbid it, he said. Dock my salary. I headed up the stairs where 5 pounds of Charleston dust awaited me. But Mr. Cannon had assured me that I labored in swirls of dust made sacred and aristocratic by the history of families who had made my native city so lovely and fine. Twice I changed the water and replenished the Epsom salts for the soaking of Mr. Cannon's splayed, ungainly feet. I went into the bathroom and retrieved the various oils and ointments to massage his swollen feet. As a man of stupendous modesty, he always made me feel like a lower order of rapist when I pulled up a chair and dried his feet with his delicate, monogrammed towels taken long ago from a family long dead. But it was part of the regimen his doctor insisted upon, and I received no credit for community service if I failed to massage Mr. Cannon's antique feet. He always made this part of our weekly ritual a moment of high drama. "Leave my tootsies alone, rapscallion," he said. "This is part of my job, Mr. Cannon," I told him. "You always make it hard, yet you and I know you like it. It makes your feet feel good." "Don't go inventing words that never came out of my mouth, boy." I caught his right foot, then swung it up on my knee, where I dried it thoroughly. The intimacy unnerved him, and he placed a towel on his head as I turned my attention to his left foot. "Next week we might need to work on the pedicure." I studied his toes. "Your pinkies look pretty good this week." "This is what I live for, Lord," he moaned. "For a common criminal to praise my feet?" I then began applying a cream made of aloe and eucalyptus and massaged his feet from the heels to the toes. Sometimes he moaned with pleasure and sometimes with pain when I applied too much pressure. My goal was to rub his feet until they glowed with a renewed, healthy circulation, or at least that was the goal his doctor required of me. Mr. Cannon suffered from sciatica and a weak back and could not bend to touch his feet. He knew my ministrations were good for his physical health, even as I offended his overdeveloped sense of modesty. "Dr. Shermetta called me last week," I told him. "For the life of me, I cannot understand why I put myself under the care of a Ukrainian." "The Ukrainian wants me to start giving you a full shower. I'm responsible for hosing down your whole body from here on in." I smiled at his towel-draped head. "I would shoot you between the eyeballs if you attempted such a thing. How ghastly! So my life has come to this. Then, after I watched you suffer agonizing death throes, I would call a taxi, drive to Ropa Hospital, and dispatch of this upstart Ukrainian. Then I would kill myself with a single shot to the head." "So you don't like the shower idea?" I asked. "Would you donate your body to science?" "That's why God created paupers," he said. "My body will be buried in my family plot of distinguished ancestors in Magnolia Cemetery." "Just how distinguished are your ancestors, Mr. Cannon?" I teased him. He caught the note of teasing and thundered, "Cannon? Cannon? Open any history book of South Carolina, and even an illiterate would stumble across my family name. They would make your sorry family look like Haitians and Puerto Ricans or even Ukrainians." "Your podiatrist has to leave now," I said. "Remember to say your prayers and always floss your teeth." Then I added in warning, "Soon I will have paid off my debt to society. What do you mean? He asked. Judge Alexander has cut my community service to 50 hours instead of 100.
That's preposterous. I'll call the judge at once. You were caught with enough cocaine to satisfy the entire ghetto of Charleston for a week.
I'll see you next Thursday. Can I bring you anything? I walked toward the front door.
Yes, he said. You can, Leo. Try to bring me some sign of good breeding, a proper bloodline, a mastery of the small courtesies, and a much greater respect for your elders. Consider it done. You've been a great disappointment to me. I thought I could make something out of you, but I've been a dismal failure.
Then why do you keep my Father's Day card in the top right-hand drawer, Mr. Cannon?
You are a rogue and a blackguard, he cried out. Never darken the door of this shop again, or I'll have a warrant out for your arrest.
See you next Thursday, Harrington.
How dare you! The impudence of using my first name!
Then softening, he said, Thursday it is, Leo.
Chapter 5. Raised by a Nun. I took Ashley Street north toward the medical college and St. Francis Hospital, where my brother and I were born. I took a ride at the old Porter Gowd Chapel, then another ride on Rutledge, and into the parking lot, where I locked my bike to a door handle of my mother's Buick. The sign that said, Principal Only, filled me with a second-hand pride as I walked toward the school that had become a safe harbor. I had come to Peninsula High in complete disgrace. I knew that was what my mother wanted to talk to me about, with my final year approaching. Sitting at her desk in her erect posture, my mother looked like she could have led a destroyer into combat.
I thought you knew I'd been a nun, she said.
No, ma'am. You never told me that.
You've been an odd enough boy, Mother said. I guess I didn't want to say something that would give you an excuse to be even odder.
Do you agree that you've been odd?
You've never seemed satisfied with me, Mother, I said, looking out the window at the traffic on Rutledge Avenue.
Your erroneous theory, not mine. And look me in the eye. She opened up a permanent file on her desk and then spent several moments studying a record that seemed odoriferous to her.
You have not distinguished yourself as a high school student, Mr. King.
I'm your son, Mother. You know how I hate it when you pretend we're not related.
I treat you just like I treat every other student in my school. If you get bad grades in high school, no good college will accept you.
I'll get into some college, I said.
But will I think it's a good one?
I could get into Harvard, and you'd think the whole Ivy League had lowered its standards.
No good college would touch you.
She studied my grades, tisk-tisking with her tongue against her teeth. Tisk-tisking belonged to the native vocabulary of nuns and atrociously bad public school teachers.
Your grade point ratio is 2.4 out of a possible 4.0. Below average. You've scored less than 1,000 on your SAT exams. You have great potential, but so far you have wasted the best years of your life. Your grades in ninth grade destroyed your grade point ratio.
I had a bad year, Mother.
Disgraceful, I would call it.
She lifted out a sheet of paper and pushed it across the desk toward me. I recognized the paper and ignored it.
That's the copy of your arrest warrant issued on the night of August 30, 1966, the night when you were found carrying a half pound of cocaine in your sports jacket. This 40-page document is the record of your trial in juvenile court. Here are the yearly reports of your probation officer. These are from your shrink, that love of your life.
Dr. Criddle has been a great help to me.
These are Judge Alexander's letters describing your progress, she continued. There are other letters describing the community service you performed to keep you from serving time in the juvenile prison system.
I'm sorry that I put my family through that, I said. But you know all that.
She cleared her throat, another nun's trick, and said, That night will follow you forever.
I made a mistake, Mother.
I'd been in and out of mental hospitals after what happened to Steve. 6 years had gone by since Steve. would you hush up about your brother? He doesn't play a part in your screw-up.
I walked into Bishop Ireland as a ninth grader. The whole school saw me as a nutcase. Kids were nervous around me. I was invited to a party, my first high school party. You and Dad were happy that I was going to be a normal kid again. Some drinking was going on, then a police raid. A guy on the football team put a bag of something in my pocket and asked me to keep it safe for him, and I said okay. I was flattered that a guy on the football team knew my name. So I got caught.
Yes. And the next day, your principal threw you out of Bishop Ireland, preventing you from getting a Catholic education, your parents' dream for you.
You were my principal, Mother. You kicked me out of school.
I was following school policy.
I resigned my position that same day. So did your father.
We both fell on our swords to support you.
Then you betrayed us by not telling the police the name of that boy who planted the cocaine on you.
I screwed up. If you'd have named that boy, nothing would have happened to you.
It wouldn't have been right to name that guy. I said it for the 100th time.
But it was all right for a senior to plant drugs on an innocent freshman?
No, it was wrong of him.
Well, you finally admit that, after 3 years.
He shouldn't have done that to me, I agreed. I see that now. I'm older, and I see it differently now.
None of it had to happen, she said, her voice rising. You didn't have any idea what drugs were. You were innocent. You were terribly used by an older boy. It was your stubbornness, your impenetrable stubbornness, the stubbornness you inherited from me. Damn it, you got it from me.
Such vulgarity, Sister Norberta. But I pitied my mother, even as I tried to joke her out of her distress. She said, moving on to another unpleasant subject, Sister Scholastica told me you were impertinent to her on the phone.
I was not. She caught me by surprise. She asked to speak to Sister Mary Norberta.
I didn't know that was your code name.
She didn't like the tone of your voice. She detected a note of sarcasm.
I was nice to her, I protested.
I thought it was a wrong number.
I'm always telling the nuns back at the convent that I'm raising you to be a feminist. Her voice glittered with self-approval. I'm the only boy in the world who knows how to work a Singer sewing machine, I said. So you obviously wanted a daughter.
I resent you even thinking that, she shot back. I've taught you useful things, things they made me learn during my novitiate that I loathed doing, but they are useful.
Yeah, the whole football team roared when they found out I made you a dress. I was still embarrassed by the memory.
You made me a dress for Mother's Day your sophomore year. It touched me more than you'll ever know.
It's still my favorite. Keep it up, Mother, and I'm going to sew another dress. Only I'll wear it to the prom. She ignored me and leaned down beside her desk to retrieve a framed photograph from her calfskin briefcase. She placed it upright before me and ordered me to study it.
You know that photograph, of course.
It's on top of Father's chest of drawers.
But it's up high. I barely could see it when I was a little kid.
You were born uncurious. You could have asked to see this picture any time.
Do you see it now?
There's Father and his parents I never knew, standing beside a nun I don't know.
Look closer at the nun.
I had seen this photograph 1,000 times, but it had always struck me as a picture of my father as an impossibly callow young man standing at attention between 2 strangers who had died before my birth. A shadow cut across the nun's cowled, veiled face, a stick figure in her time-honored anonymity and medieval finery. Only as I studied it did my own mother's face materialize. I could almost experience a field of force drawing my parents toward each other.
It was like observing a pornographic chapter of my own history that had been written in invisible ink.
I felt like I was trapped in a half-told life, a world of semi-lies and baffling fractions of controversial half-truths.
I was staring at a photograph I had seen every day.
It nearly brought me to my knees when I realized
I was privy to the translations of all its opacities and secrets for the first time. In black and white, here was proof that my mother had been a member of a convent. I was trying to unravel the complicated trigonometry of the radical thought that silence could make up the greatest lie ever told. But on that day, I was far too young and unformed to hold a thought that deep. It etherized around me as I found myself in the gun sights of my mother's withering gaze again. "Mother," I said finally, "I never knew you were such a living doll." "Thanks to the nth power, son." "I did not mean it the way it sounded." I studied the photo with more attention. "You and father were always so much older than the other kids' parents." "I felt old when I had my first child," she said. "Much older when I had my second." "Your second? I guess that's me." "I guess it is," my mother answered in her blank voice, the one that didn't fire live ammunition or anything else that seemed real. "So you just quit being a nun?" "I didn't know you could do that." "You can't. Your father's going to explain it all to you. I left the job to him." She looked at her watch. "He's waiting for you now." My father handed me 2 tackle boxes, our favorite rods and reels, and a bucket of live bait I had caught by casting a shrimp net into the estuarine lake off Lockwood Boulevard, a lake that flooded our backyard during heavy spring tides. We walked down to the harbor. He untied the ropes on the mooring of the city dock where we kept a small fishing bateau. Father pulled the starter of the modest 15-horsepower outboard, and we moved out toward the center of the Ashley River, which formed the western border of the Charleston Peninsula. Both of us baited up and cast our lines on opposite sides of the boat as the moon appeared in the east, as bright as a spoon. The Ashley was a hiding place and a workshop and a safe house for my father and me to be alone with each other, to bask in the pleasure of each other's company, and to cure all the hurts the world brought to us. At first we fished wordlessly and let the primal silence of the river translate us into no more than drifting shapes. The tide was a poem that only time could create, and I watched it stream and brim and make its steady dash homeward to the ocean. The sun was sinking fast, and a laundry line full of cirrus clouds stretched along the western sky like boas of white linen, then surrendered to a shiver of gold that haloed my father's head. The river held the gold shine for a brief minute, then went dark as the moon rose up behind us. In silence, we fished as father and son, each watching his line. In the pale light, my father was a luminous silhouette, an emperor incised on a strange coin. With the movement of tides and the stillness of gentle fathers, and the heartache one felt in the death of hot Charleston days, the Atlantic called out to us. Fishing gave me time to think and to pray and to sit with the man who had rarely raised his voice to me in my entire childhood. Because he was a scientist, his method of being a father was explanatory, and he made being his son feel like a tutorial. Even during the terrible time of Steve's death, my father never employed a tone that did not convey a respect for every part of my boyhood. When I went crazy in the days following Steve's funeral, he considered it the most natural thing in the world. Though I was now entering a time when I could not remember what my brother looked or sounded like, I could study my father's face and see my brother sitting in the boat with us. His face was tender in repose, yet it often carried a haunted look when I could tell that he was thinking of Steve, too. His lips would grow thin as though they were drawn with a ruler. His cheekbones were high and prominent, and though his eyebrows were thick, they were symmetrical and matched the strong curve of his nose. His glasses, as thick as mine, overemphasized his mahogany brown eyes.
He was a thoughtful man with a streak of mischievousness and an obsessive love of my mother. This fishing trip was arranged for him to tell me about it, and I waited for it to grow dark enough for him to talk. Only after dark did my father tell me the things that really mattered, and it had been on such a night, when I was a small child, and with Steve in the boat, that he had paused and reflected on the glories of the Charleston sunset, bathed in crimson, and sighed, "Ah, boys, behold the mansion on the river." We were starting later tonight. The red drained from the horizon, the sky metal blue as we drifted near the docks of the Coast Guard base. I handed my father my fishing pole, grabbed the oars, and moved us back toward the middle of the river. I straightened the boat as we began our drifting passage before the houses along the battery. They were lit up like theaters, and we could hear the voices of families talking on their verandas and porches. Downriver, a chamber orchestra was warming up before a small crowd that had gathered in White Point Gardens, which at this distance sounded like the conversation of field mice. Twice we dropped anchor, then floated toward Fort Sumter. "Tell me about the phone call from Sister Scholastica, son," Father asked as we anchored for the third time. "It wasn't much. She hit me with the news that she had attended a convent with my mother. I was surprised, that's all." "After Steve," my father said, then had to catch himself and get his voice back. "After Steve, your mother always insisted that we remain silent about the early part of her life. Steve knew something about it, but not much. We wanted to emphasize us as a family, not your mother's life before we were married." "Don't you think it's a bit weird?" "No. Like the moon up there, Leo. Every life goes through different phases. It's part of natural law. And before we were together, the phase your mother went through was her years as an ordained nun. Granted, it lasted a long time, but still, you'd have to classify it as a phase." "It explains everything. Jesus Christ, I've been raised by a nun. I bet that's why I call her mother and you father, right? Here we are living in the middle of Mama and Daddy Land, the South, and I go around sounding like Prince Charles by saying, 'Mother dear.'" "Nothing wrong with that," my father, not my daddy, explained. "She looks like a nun, acts like a nun, talks like a nun, and breathes like a nun. I was raised under false pretenses. Kids my age have always thought I was weird, and they've been right. Something's always been a little off about me. I think you've been perfect in every way. You're prejudiced. That's my job. The fact that I was raised by a nun and didn't even know it explains why I've been an altar boy for an early morning mass for practically my whole life. Why we say an endless rosary before we go to bed each night. I mean, come on, Father. What is it about the Hail Mary you don't get the first 1,000 times you pray it? I'd like to dig up whoever invented the rosary and desecrate their bones." He chuckled, then paused and grew serious again. "The rosary is a spiritual discipline, Leo. It brings us close to God." "It's a bore," I said, then added, "and a pain in the ass. Your language, son." "Sorry." "How'd you meet Mother?" "She said you'd tell me the story." "It's a nice story," he said it with infinite shyness. "The very best a man like me could hope to have." "What do you mean, a man like you?" He said, "You know what I mean. A homely man. An ugly man." "Why do you think you're ugly?" He grinned. "Next time you're near my bathroom, walk in and look around. I happen to own a mirror." "You're not ugly, Father." "Then I need to buy a new mirror. Mine keeps lying to me." He laughed at his own joke before pulling the rope and starting the engine again as I hauled in the anchor. Our eyes watched the families in the generous houses facing the river. We saw a ballerina practicing in an upstairs studio. two roller skaters moving without effort down the battery seawall, sliding as though on ice, their hands behind their backs. Bicycles moved along the streets with headlights as dull as flashlights lighting their ways. Killing the motor as we drew opposite the Fort Sumter Hotel, we watched men order from menus by the glow of candlelight. Lovers promenaded the length and breadth of the battery, some couples stopping to kiss at the exact point where the Ashley and the Cooper met to form Charleston's fragrant harbor. We baited our hooks and cast our lines. "I knew your mother my whole life, Leo," Father said. "But I didn't even begin to know her until we were juniors at Bishop Island, and I saw her sunbathing on a floating dock off a plantation on James Island. This was the summer of 1937, and the whole world was about to change. I was early to the party. Like you, I didn't date much in high school. I'm not sure I was as shy as you are, but it's a possibility. I was tongue-tied when a girl was waiting for me to talk. Something about seeing your mother on that dock changed all that. Something broke inside me, and I felt a million words tumble out, and I ran down that plantation lawn toward the dock. On that run, I decided that I wanted to marry your mother." "Oh, come on. Nothing happens that fast. Who's telling this story?" He described my mother's pale blue bathing suit, her pretty legs and figure, and his surprise when she stood up and dove into the salt creek just before he arrived at his destiny. Backstroking against the tide, my mother saw him silhouetted in sunlight and asked, "Jasper, where is your bathing suit? We could go swimming together." He grabbed an inner tube from the dock, removed his shoes, and dove into the water fully clothed, a gesture he considered the most romantic and spontaneous of his life. "Have you gone crazy or something, Jasper?" My mother squealed with laughter as he replied, "Something like that. Crazy for you, I think. You've ruined your clothes. My clothes will be fine, but I'd like you to pitch in some money to help me replace a watch and a perfectly good leather wallet. That's what you get for taking leave of your senses, Jasper King. If you could see the way you looked from up there on that lawn, you'd know why I got a little jumpy, Lindsay Weaver."
"Looked? What do you mean, how I looked?"
"You looked like the queen of the world." Drifting toward Charleston, she said, "I think I like that answer, Jasper King. I think I like it very much." Staring at each other across the diameter of that inner tube, the couple began to tell each other the stories of their lives, the ones that really mattered, the ones that remained secret until the right boy comes around the corner or the perfect girl comes walking down the street. Taking turns, they told tales of their innocent lives that defined who they were. By the time Jasper's father had come by boat to retrieve the two swimmers, Jasper and Lindsay were in love and didn't care who knew it. Both their classmates and their families joked about their elopement at sea when they returned to the gathering sunburned and unable to take their eyes off each other. When a storm hit that evening, they remained on the dock holding hands as the entire party observed them from the dry safety of the plantation manor house, while the lashing winds leaned into the palmettos and worried the live oaks along the river's edge. The rain came in heavy sheets, and Lindsay and Jasper still sat holding hands, oblivious to the world and to the party playing out behind them. They talked to each other as though they had just discovered speech. Neither Lindsay nor Jasper had ever had a real boyfriend or girlfriend, and both expressed the thought that they had been waiting their whole lives for this day to happen. No one who saw them that day ever thought that Lindsay or Jasper would ever marry anyone else. If you're deeply religious, and my parents were back then and still were as I sat with my father in the boat, you would have to know that they thought it was God who arranged that chance encounter. They were simply following his inexorable design for how he wanted their lives to be lived. During that summer, My mother and father thought they were living the greatest love story ever written. A quiet man, my father spoke to me of his courtship of my mother as though he were praying. He kept his eyes fastened on the line that disappeared into the black waters and chose his words with care. Before this tell-all night, I had barely known that my parents had been teenagers together. They had been older than the parents of my peers and had once been mistaken for my grandparents. As I fished and listened and took in my father's words, I realized he was introducing me to a passionate young couple I never dreamed existed. That June, Jasper got a job at Berlin's clothing store. He ate Sunday dinner with the Weaver family after Mass each weekend. During that magical summer, Lindsay and Jasper would walk through Charleston's trimmed, ethereal parks and churchyards and avenues, talking about their bright future as husband and wife. They would walk holding hands from one end of the Battery to the other, waving to the freighters putting out to sea. Once Jasper climbed a magnolia tree searching out the perfect blossom as an accessory for my mother's jet-black hair. When he pinned it in her hair and she caught her reflection in the side mirror of a parked Buick, they declared it their favorite flower and promised they would get married only when they could cover the altar with magnolias. Another night, they decided to kiss in front of all their favorite Charleston houses and almost didn't make it home for Lindsay's curfew. "I don't get it," I said. "How did all this kissing lead to the convent?" He chuckled. "I'm getting to that part." Since Jasper and Lindsay were both daily communicants, they would meet on the steps of the cathedral every morning of the early Mass. Jasper had never known anyone, male or female, to surrender himself or herself to the transforming power of prayer the way his beloved did every single morning. She accepted the Eucharist in complete rapture as a feast shared with the Godhead. She yielded to its mysteries with a submission that permitted no contention or rivalry. Where Jasper found impasses and obstacles that stood in the way of harmony with the spiritual world, Lindsay found its access easy. Jasper's view of Catholicism was simple. His job was to accept the church's teaching and to attempt to live a good and decent life. Lindsay believed with all her heart that sainthood was the only logical pursuit of a good Christian. Not only did she want to join Christ in his suffering during his crisis in Gethsemane, she wished it to be a place with her footprints all over the garden, a refuge to which she could run barefooted with her arm outstretched to her Lord in agony. It was not just faith that Lindsay Weaver brought to the altar rail each day. It was a complete immersion and a perfect affinity with its mysteries. Jasper's love did not stand a chance against such immovable faith. In the following school year, Jasper King lost Lindsay Weaver. In September, a young priest named Maxwell Sadler, fresh from his ordination in Rome, came to the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist to begin his vocation as a parish priest and a teacher of religion at Bishop Ireland High School. In the Catholic world, the priest's sermon at Sunday Mass was the only part of the service rendered in English, but it might as well have been spoken in Sanskrit for all the spiritual nourishment it provided. When it came to their homilies, there was nothing living that a Catholic priest could not put to sleep. Maxwell Sadler changed that perception forever in the Diocese of Charleston. Jasper and Lindsay were sitting together when the strikingly handsome young priest strode to the pulpit to deliver his first sermon. For a long moment, he stared out at the congregation and waited until there was discomfort and fidgeting at this silence. Then, at that moment, he roared out, "Johnny Jones went to church every single Sunday." There was another long pause, a wait, and Father Max finished his couplet. "Johnny Jones went to hell for what he did on Monday." The new priest spoke in tongues of southern fire and began to fill the cathedral. In the first months of his priesthood, he drew down the jealousy of Bishop Rice, who found his preaching vain and somewhat sinister. When he began to teach the seniors of Bishop Ireland that September, he called his course Theology 101, and he changed the way each of his students thought about their relationship to their loving God. It was like having a matinee idol put his handprint on your soul. It was Maxwell Sadler who first admitted to Lindsay that he believed she had received a call to the sisterhood. He told her he knew a perfect convent of a teaching order in North Carolina that she could attend. He insisted that he'd had a vision and witnessed the ceremony in which she took the veil. Secretly, without telling Jasper, Lindsay applied and was accepted as a novice at the convent in Belmont, North Carolina. Father Sadler also tried to talk my father into taking a long, serious look at the priesthood. In his innocence, my father told Father Sadler that he had already committed his life to marrying my mother and raising a good Catholic family. On the Christmas break of their senior year, Lindsay broke up with Jasper and announced her intention to enter the convent the following June after her graduation. He did not take the news well. He said things to Lindsay that he would be ashamed of for the rest of his life, and it all came back to him in a rush of emotion as we fished together in the Ashley River. He had accused her of leading him on and ruining his life for nothing but the most selfish reasons. For hours, he begged and pleaded with her to change her mind, but to no avail. For a month afterward, they did not speak to each other and could not even bear to catch each other's eyes as they passed in the hallways of Bishop Ireland. Force of habit brought them together at the cathedral, and eventually their friendship survived the ordeal of their blasted love affair. At times, Jasper's bitterness would rise up between them, but she would bring him back down to her by reminding him of his own devotion to the same God to whom she was surrendering her life and their future. When Lindsay left her family for Belmont, she asked that Jasper do her the favor of delivering her to the convent steps. He accepted with graciousness and resignation. On the morning of June 16, 1938, he drove the back roads and they entered the convent grounds at nightfall. Lindsay had packed very little. All the worldly possessions she would need fit in the smallest of bags. They both got out of the car, and Jasper lingered behind as she walked up and rang a bell that could be heard throughout the convent. A sister answered the door and made a motion for Lindsay to enter, where two other nuns awaited to ship her down a long hallway. Her new life was starting.
"Are you Jasper?" the first nun asked.
"Yes, sister. I'm Jasper."
"She wrote me about you," the nun said. "My name is Sister Mary Michelle. I'm the Mother Superior here. Could I come to visit Lindsay? Not often, just every once in a while." "That doesn't sound like a good idea," Sister Michelle said. "Can I write her?" "You can if you wish," the nun said. "I can't promise they'll be delivered. She belongs to this order now."
"Then can I do something for the convent? Is there anything you need? I could buy it for you."
The nun thought about it, then said, "Soap. We could use some soap for the sisters to bathe with."
The next day, Jasper drove into Charlotte and cut a deal with a manager of Belk Department Store to have 10 boxes of a simple but elegant women's hand soap sent to the convent of the Sacred Heart. In her first note to him, Sister Michelle revealed to Jasper that the gift had been controversial from the start, some of the older nuns thinking the soap far too luxurious for convent use. But Sister Michelle had reasoned with them and explained the nature of the gift, as well as the sin of wastefulness and the importance of cleanliness in the convent's daily life. It began an annual pilgrimage for Jasper King. He would show up at the convent door on June 16 of each year and ask Sister Mary Michelle if he could visit with Lindsay, who had undergone her metamorphosis into Sister Mary Norberta. Though my father's visit often caught Sister Michelle off guard, she was a practical woman. "What does the convent require this year?" Jasper asked the Mother Superior one year. "Laundry detergent," Sister Michelle said. And the next day, a year's supply of detergent arrived at the convent's delivery door at the backside of the building. The following year, it was floor polish. The next year, hand towels. And the next year, shoe polish. A small but important friendship sprang up between Jasper and Sister Michelle, and they began to look forward to their June 16 encounters. She would give Jasper reports on Norberta's progress, and one time Sister Michelle said, "She's got more natural talent than any young woman I've ever seen at this convent." These reports both pleased Jasper and filled him with dread. Each time he approached the pretty convent, he hoped to find Lindsay waiting for him on the front steps, holding her small bag and wearing the same dress as the one she wore on the trip up from Charleston. Jasper wanted to see Lindsay rushing into his arms, declaring that it had all been an unfortunate misunderstanding. That first September, he entered the gates of the Citadel, following in the footsteps of his father and grandfather, pleasing his family immensely. But he was well aware that he chose to attend the Citadel only because he had never taken the time to form a plan of his life that did not include Lindsay. He became a physics major and soon understood that he was subject to the laws of inertia like all other objects on Earth, and that Lindsay's abandonment had set him in motion toward an unplanned, though ineluctable, destiny. He found it easy to surrender himself to the codes of discipline of the Citadel, fell in love with the natural order of the regiment, and took a young man's pleasure in the care of uniforms, in marching in step to the beating of drums and the calling of cadence. As the convent was a hermitage of women devoted to prayer, the Citadel became a priesthood for Jasper. That priesthood turned into a caste of warriors on December 7, 1941, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. When Jasper took his physical for the Army, he had memorized the eye chart used by military optometrists and so passed the vision test with a perfect score. He entered the war as a second lieutenant and fought with distinction in the European theater, entered Normandy in the third wave on D-Day, took part in the liberation of Paris, and had just spent his first night in Germany when VE Day was declared. After a year with the occupation army in Germany, he was sent home to Charleston to begin his real life without Lindsay. Jasper had written her a letter once a week all during the war, but she had never seen a single one. Sister Mary Michelle prided herself in possessing more than a layman's knowledge of human nature, and she could feel Jasper's love for Lindsay pulsing in every line. So she had kept the letters from the young woman. During the war, Jasper insisted that his father appear at the doorway of the Sacred Heart Convent every June 16 and ask Sister Michelle about their needs for the coming year. "My grandfather did not enjoy the commission, but he did it because he was superstitious enough that he believed his son might be killed in battle if he refused to perform a charitable act for a convent full of nuns. As requested, my grandfather honored the anniversary of Lindsay's delivery to her vocation and appeared without fail on the afternoon of June 16. On the battlefields of Europe, Jasper received four brief thank-you notes from Sister Michelle and assurances that the young Sister Norberta was a rising star. Her superiors were quick to identify Lindsay's intellect, and after taking the veil, she enrolled in Catholic University. In a rigorous, accelerated program, she completed her work for her doctorate in English literature and already began writing her dissertation on Ulysses. On her first reading, she had discovered that the novel's action all took place on a single day, June 16, 1904. Because it was the same day that Jasper had driven her to the convent to begin her life in the sisterhood, the date acquired a magical significance to Lindsay. Often, she would think about Jasper. She knew from her parents that he was part of the war in Europe, and she prayed for his safe return as she took communion every morning. When she received word from Sister Michelle that Jasper had survived the war, it convinced her further that the power of prayer was a natural, unimpeachable force for good in the universe. In her heart, she believed it was her prayers and entreaties that had brought Jasper safely home from Europe. He returned to Charleston, got a job teaching science at Bishop Ireland High School, and moved into his old room at his parents' house on Rutledge Avenue. He limited his social life to an occasional date with a new teacher at Bishop Ireland or with the sisters of his classmates at the Citadel. He made an affable and at least acceptably attractive partner, and several women let him know that they were ready for a serious commitment if he had finally been cured of his famous case of puppy love. Whenever the subject came up, he made fun of himself for his constant infatuation with a woman who had made herself unavailable to any man. But he had promised himself he would never marry a woman unless he felt exactly like he had when he floated, fully clothed, on an inner tube caught in the tidal currents of Charleston Harbor when he was 17 years old. He knew exactly what love was and how it was supposed to feel. In the summer of 1949, he bought a 2-acre lot on the saltwater lake along the Ashley River that was separated from the river by Lockwood Boulevard. With the help of friends, he built a 2-story brick home that added little to the architectural significance of his city. The house was as functional and as homely as a Catholic church built in the Charleston suburbs of that era. He built a working science lab in an upstairs room in the back of the house, and even his mother teased him for building a 5-bedroom house for what was likely to remain a bachelor pad. But Jasper had developed a long-range plan that he thought would take some of the sting out of bachelorhood and help with the mortgage payments. He invited other young bachelors teaching at the high school to rent rooms from him, and he always had at least 3 male teachers living there. He remembered it as a happy time, because there was a house party almost every weekend, and the laughter of young men and women dancing together was a kind of music that the house needed badly. Several of these young men became some of the best friends Jasper made in a lifetime rich in friendships. Even Father Maxwell Sadler spent 6 months in an upstairs bedroom after an electrical fire damaged his rectory. Jasper did not charge the priest for rent, and he was sorry when Father Max moved back to the rectory when the repairs were finished. Few of his other housemates knew of his deep love of Lindsay, and he felt free to talk of his unquenchable love for her with Father Max. With infinite patience, Father Max never tried to talk Jasper out of his constancy toward Lindsay. Instead, he introduced him to other pretty young Catholic girls whom he met in his work. Because of Jasper's bachelorhood, false rumors of homosexuality made their way along the corridors of Bishop Ireland, which Jasper did little to eliminate as he resigned himself to a single life. After his first years back in the city, there were fewer and fewer sightings of Jasper at cotillion balls or dinners with eligible young women in downtown restaurants or in the back rows of the Dock Street Theater. A fellow English teacher asked Jasper to cruise a gay bar with him one weekend, and Jasper never spoke a civil word to that colleague again. Instead, he grew more inward with the passage of each year, more judgmental and pietistic and rigid, and young teachers stopped being comfortable renting rooms in his house. Living alone did not prove beneficial to Jasper, and his habits began to turn slowly into noticeable eccentricities. He took the effects of loneliness to heart, but failed to note the corrosion of his sunny personality. The silences of his house caused him to reflect and despair of a life that might have been perfect. Still, he wrote to his beloved nun once a week and sent the letters to the convent in care of Sister Michelle. He would sometimes tell himself it was high time that he met and fell in love with another woman, but the falseness of the words tortured him. Writing his former girlfriend, he invented stories of beach parties, sailing trips to Bermuda, art openings, A planned summer trip to Europe, the purchase of a golden retriever, a fishing trip to the Gulf of Mexico, a spiritual retreat to Mepkin Abbey, and 100 other remarkable events that never happened. His letters were pure fiction. My father may have been the first man in history who lived in fear of boring a nun. On June 16 of every year, he kept his appointment with Sister Michelle in Belmont. One year, Jasper brought 50 pounds of fresh, ice-down shrimp that he had collected off a shrimp boat at Shem Creek. Another year, he unloaded 100 small azalea plants that he had cultivated and grown in a makeshift greenhouse in the back of his house. Always, Jasper brought bushels of fresh tomatoes, cucumbers, and corn from a farm on Wadmala Island. He brought boiled peanuts and jars of jellies, chutneys, and preserves he had put up himself. The Mother Superior enjoyed the young man's sense of humor and the romantic hopelessness of the cause he pursued in spite of the fact that she offered him no encouragement and would not allow him to broach the subject of his former girlfriend. Sister Michelle never told him that Sister Noberta had not been in residence at the convent since 1940 and was spending that summer teaching literature at the University of Notre Dame. Nor did she once reveal that convent rules forbade her to deliver his letters to his former love. But she did break a convent rule by saving the letters and keeping them boxed in her office, tied with a white ribbon. That she saved his letters bothered her not at all. But that she had read every one of them with avidity and even pleasure, she considered a kind of minor league sin. On June 16, 1948, she treated Jasper to lunch at a downtown Charlotte restaurant famous for its steak. During the meal, he asked, "What does the convent need this year, sister?" The nun laughed. "You won't believe this, Jasper, but we need hand soap." "That's what I gave you the first time I met you," he said. "You gals need to bathe more." When Jasper left her that day, Sister Michelle surprised him by kissing him lightly on the cheek and thanked him for all he had done for the convent over the years. The kiss was a strangeness and a kindness, and he had an entire year to interpret its meaning. At the high school, an accidental fire set by an incompetent student shut down his chemistry lab. His mother began showing the first signs of dementia, and his father was diagnosed with cancer of the larynx. He moved back home to care for his parents, and he rented his house to four bachelors who taught in various high schools. His house became infamous for hosting the wildest parties in the city. But he was too busy to care, and for the first time, he almost forgot his June 16 appointment at the Convent of the Sacred Heart. 11 years after Jasper had delivered Lindsay Weaver to the door, a younger nun he had never seen before motioned for him to follow her to the visitor's room after he informed her that he had an appointment with the Mother Superior. The young nun nodded and moved out of the room, as silent as wood smoke. Another nun appeared at the top of the stairs leading to the visitor's room. Sunlight poured through a Palladian window and framed the outline of the nun, who moved too gracefully to be Sister Michelle. The sunlight now hit the lenses of Jasper's glasses, blinding him. Squinting, he said to the figure on the stairs, "I was expecting my old friend Sister Michelle." "Sister Michelle died of a stroke over a month ago," the nun said. "I've been selected as the acting superior of the convent. That's why I'm meeting you here today." "Why didn't anyone get in touch with me?" Jasper asked. "Her death was very sudden and unexpected," he said. "I'm so sorry. I'd grown close to Sister Michelle." Still blinded by the bright sun, he turned his head, removed his glasses, and began cleaning them with a white handkerchief. "Even though you can't see me clearly, don't you know my voice, Jasper?" the acting Mother Superior asked. She moved out of the sun and into the shadow of that funereal room where visitors and family members summoned the nuns of their lives from the mysterious upstairs hideaways. when Jasper saw her face. He fell to his knees and howled like a wounded animal. His shriek brought nuns running from all corners of the convent. Sister Norberta was now in the unenviable position of explaining why this out-of-control man had gotten to his knees in front of her. Sister Michelle had been the only one who knew the whole story of this love-struck, weeping man.
"Should I call the police?"
asked the young nun who had led Jasper to this room.
"No, of course not. This is Jasper King. He makes a large donation to the convent each year. I just told him about the death of our good sister Michelle. They were close friends."
"Then should I call a priest?" asked another nun.
"No, no, Jasper will be fine. Can someone bring us a glass of iced tea? Do you still like sweet tea, Jasper?"
Several nuns helped Jasper to his feet and into a chair. His body appeared boneless and weightless. When the tea came, it seemed to revive him, and he thanked the nun who brought it. He was disoriented and now extremely mortified over the spectacle he had made. Quietly, the other nun slipped out of sight.
"Sorry, Lindsay. I mean, Sister Norberta," he stammered.
"I'd given up all chances of ever seeing you again. You caught me off guard."
"Off guard, Jasper?" she laughed.
"I guess I did. I had no idea you had such a theatrical side."
"Neither did I,"
he said, and they both laughed. In our small boat, in the tangy, salt-brimmed air, I reeled in a nice-sized bass as my father described his elation at seeing Lindsay Weaver again.
"So you didn't recognize her?" I asked when I realized he was too overwhelmed to continue.
"She was in the light," he said finally. "The light came over her shoulder into my eyes."
"But her voice?"
"I wasn't expecting ever to hear it again. Nothing had prepared me for this encounter, Leo. I'd reconciled myself to never seeing her again. Didn't even know I'd done it, but I had."
"What did Mother say?" I asked.
"After you settled down." Reeling in his line, my father put another live shrimp on his hook before casting it over toward James Island in a smooth, athletic motion. Then he continued his story. As they sat in armchairs that faced each other, Jasper studied Sister Norberta's face and found himself dismayed that 11 years of separation from this woman had done nothing to dampen his boyish ardor for her. Lindsay's beauty had deepened with age and with the contemplative life she had chosen.
"I never got over you, Lindsay," he said.
"Please call me Sister Norberta."
"I never got over you, Sister Norberta."
"I know that, Jasper," she said. "Sister Michelle told me about your visits. At first, she disapproved of you greatly, but she softened over the years. You got to her, Jasper, by your persistence, your generosity toward the convent, and your kindness. She began to cherish your yearly visits.
And she loved your letters.
Did you ever see any of them?"
"Not when they were written, but last summer Sister Michelle and I were on retreat together. A forest near the retreat house had beautiful pathways, and we'd take long walks. She started talking about you. She told me that she felt I had never really belonged in the convent. That night, she gave me the box containing your letters."
"Did you read them?"
"Yes, Jasper. I read every one of them."
"What did you think?"
"I'll have an answer for you someday. Not today, but soon. I promise."
Already, Lindsay had initiated the convoluted and Byzantine process of being released from the vows of sisterhood. Her decision pleased no one, and she had to convince the head of her order in America of her seriousness, who forwarded that request to the order's headquarters in Europe, who passed it along to the world of men, and all the way to the offices of the Pope himself. To Lindsay, the pace seemed snail-like and agonizing. But for her time and place in a church locked into the embers of its immovable laws, Lindsay's deliverance from her vows arrived in a timely manner. The See of Rome, exhausted by the travails of World War II, was dealing with the broken Catholic soul of a ruined Europe. It had little energy to waste on a southern nun who had discovered late that she had other fish to fry. Her letter of manumission was signed by Pope Pius XII himself.